From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Donald Trump hearts Kim Jong-un of North Korea, and Angela Merkel and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan have a meeting in Germany with mixed results. This is Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I am Joseph Sternberg, filling in again for Mary Kissel. And I am coming to you from our podcasting studio here on the banks of the River Thames in London, speaking to my friend and colleague Hugo Restall on the line from his accustomed, secure, undisclosed location in Asia. Hi, Hugo.
Hi, Joe. Good to be with you again.
Well, it's great to have you here because we are going to your part of the world to talk about what else Donald Trump and North Korea. You know, just when you thought it couldn't get any stranger, we have President Trump at a campaign appearance in Wheeling, West Virginia this weekend, talking about how he and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un fell in love after Kim wrote Trump beautiful letters and characterized the U.S. as having a very good relationship with North Korea. Hugo, this is a very strange turn in a story that has already seen so many strange turns, from the fire and fury comments that we heard from Trump threatening North Korea last year to a summit in June in Singapore where the leaders seemed to be getting along and striking some sort of deal to denuclearize North Korea and the Korean Peninsula. And then we had concerns about whether they trusted each other and North Korea was living up to whatever agreements it had made to President Trump in Singapore. And now it seems to be back on. I mean, as love affairs go, this one is very tempestuous.
Right. This is like a Harlequin romance novel with a bodice ripping cover on the front. Trump is, I think, you know, partly was joking around. I mean, let's be charitable and say he is not in love with Kim Jong-un, but is trying to emphasize the rapport, just as he has done with other world leaders, especially Xi Jinping. Apparently, the relationship with Xi Jinping is on the rocks now, so maybe that's why Trump is being so warm toward Kim Jong-un.
Well, I feel like we need to take a look at this issue two ways. And I mean, one has to do with just the underlying issue of diplomacy on the Korean Peninsula, because, I mean, it has been a very rocky relationship, even in this era when we were told that the summit in Singapore back in June was going to, hark a new cooperation here. I mean, one of the problems that I see with this kind of rhetoric from President Trump is that it seems like it's rewarding Kim Jong-un with a very positive relationship with the U.S. when we haven't actually seen any progress on a lot of the underlying problems that were causing tension in the first place. So we've had a lot of talk from Pyongyang about dealing with the, you know, denuclearizing or trying to ratchet down tensions, but we haven't seen a lot of action yet.
Right. So tactically, it's a very strange time for a remark like this. It was actually the same day that the North Korean foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, was addressing the UN General Assembly and was being relatively tough on the U.S., saying the U.S. has to regain North Korea's trust before there'll be any further progress. So for Trump to come out and say this on Saturday night doesn't make a whole lot of sense as a tactical maneuver. The North Koreans are essentially saying that they want the U.S. to make further concessions before they'll even consider doing anything substantive on denuclearization. Most people think that that would mean a statement ending the Korean War from 1950 to 53, setting the countries on the road towards a formal peace treaty, and presumably also relaxing sanctions to some degree.
And, you know, beyond that, we also just can't underestimate how damaging, how untrue it is for Trump to be talking about Kim in such glowing terms when, you know, also you have this factor which also hangs like a cloud over so much of Korean diplomacy, this problem of Kim's oppression of his people at home. I mean, it seems like you're sending a very bad message when, you know, as you've just pointed out, Trump is rewarding, you know, sort of at best very mixed diplomatic behavior, and at the same time is dialing back on some of the stronger and you know, much more helpful rhetoric that we had had from Washington earlier in the year about the human rights abuses at home, about the fact that there is something fundamentally illegitimate about a regime that acts towards its own way, its own people, the way that Kim treats his North Korean citizens.
If we go back to January, when Trump gave his State of the Union address, he brought a North Korean dissident as his guest to the speech and really laid out what a horrific regime North Korea is, and you know, that it really stands out in the 20th century litany of totalitarian states. The North Korean state is arguably the worst. So for and Kim Jong-un, it must be said also, has not changed that whatsoever. I mean, the gulags continue to imprison hundreds of thousands of North Koreans in horrendous conditions where they're essentially worked to death for any sort of political crime. And so, North Korea is the poster child for bad human rights. What does this do to U.S. credibility on the issue when it comes to other states, that if you make nice with Donald Trump and send him beautiful letters, perhaps you can avoid having your human rights record criticized.
Now, you know, you, Hugo, and Mary Kissel and I and you know, many guests on this podcast over the past couple of years have been trying to figure out whether there is something that you could properly call a Trump doctrine when it comes to foreign policy. And I think, you know, so far we haven't found one. We've been talking more about a Trump style or a Trump method instead of an actual system of belief that is animating that. And, you know, from that context, I think that it is important to also talk about the context in which you know, Trump made this fell in love comment over the weekend. It was at a campaign rally in West Virginia, and yet he was talking to a lot of his supporters, and the message seemed to be, look at how I am delivering results on foreign policy problems simply by having a good relationship with a leader like Kim Jong-un. It, you know, it's a seems to be a means of measuring success on foreign policy and of trying to explain to American voters what success looks like that is completely devoid of you know, any sense of what the actual outcome will be, that is all about the style or the success of carrying on negotiations or developing a warm and fuzzy relationship with someone.
Right. So having big profile events is the marker in the Trump view of paying attention to an issue. Whereas with North Korea, what's really required is a lot of more low profile work to isolate the regime, as the U.S. government was doing in the first half of the year, and working with allies and trying to constrain North Korea diplomatically and economically. So, you know, Donald Trump essentially ran out of patience with that approach and wanted to go for the big win with the summit in Singapore in June with Kim Jong-un, and sold that to the U.S. people as a one-time deal where the North Koreans would have a chance to denuclearize, but if they don't, you know, I'm going to get tough on them again. The problem with what's happening now is that the North Koreans are stalling. They're not carrying through on their promise. But Trump, if anything, is becoming more effusive in his praise for Kim Jong-un. So how does that help us use our leverage against North Korea when we've told them that our patience is limited and you have a one-time opportunity to give up your nuclear weapons? They don't do anything, and then we go on pretending that we're making progress.
Yeah, North Korea just increasingly, you know, strikes me as an example of both the very best and the very worst of President Trump's foreign policy instincts, because it's a case where, you know, the basic insight was correct, that this was a situation where American diplomacy had not been working for a considerable amount of time. That the North had continued making progress on its nuclear program, was becoming a growing danger to its neighbors and to U.S. interests, and potentially even the U.S. itself. That we were overdue for a rethink on how to approach that problem. And early on, Trump was prepared to be a disruptor in that sense. He brought in new ways of trying to talk about the problem, of trying to strategically ratchet up the tension a little bit to try to bring North Korea into cooperation, that you had some of the sanctions pressure that we hadn't really seen effectively used in a while. And yet, I think that the problem that you run into, the great failure of Trump's foreign policy to date, has been that lack of follow-through, the lack of patience, the lack of a capacity to say, now that we've chosen this path, we need to stick on it for a while to give it a chance to actually work.
Mm-hmm. After the summit in June, the Trump administration's line was that we needed North Korea to provide an accounting of its nuclear programs and its missile programs that violated UN resolutions, and some sort of timetable toward denuclearization. And we really haven't gotten either of those things. The North Koreans essentially said, yes, we'd like to denuclearize sometime by the end of Trump's first term, but nothing more specific than that. Really, all we've gotten so far is a moratorium on testing, which is positive, but it doesn't preclude the North Koreans continuing to work on nuclear weapons. They're continuing to make more fuel material for nuclear weapons, and they can continue to do research without testing, of course, using the results of the tests they've conducted so far. So we're giving them time to solidify their program and making it tougher in future, and essentially kicking the can down the road, as Trump has accused previous presidents of doing, quite rightly. After initially saying that he would not be doing that, that seems to be he seems to be reverting to the standard procedure.
And I think it's important to conclude just by pointing out that this isn't really only about Trump and North Korea anymore, because at the same time that Washington has been trying to ramp up its efforts to deal with the North Korea nuclear problem, we also have this simultaneous effort underway in Iran to try to ratchet up sanctions pressure on the regime in Tehran to try to address weaknesses in the 2015 nuclear pact that will prevent that country from sprinting toward a nuclear weapon in the not-too-distant future. So, I think that it is just so important for people to remember that North Korea is not the only audience for this kind of comment. There are a lot of other audiences where the U.S. also needs to be able to project a strong united front on some of these questions. And right now, whatever other successes that he might be ramping up, Donald Trump isn't doing that. We've been talking about Donald Trump's tortured love affair with North Korea, and this is Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. Another new episode is coming soon as we look at science, technology, and their influence on our lives. The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. The future is closer than you think. From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I'm Joseph Sternberg, and I've got my friend and colleague Hugo Restall on the line from Asia. Hugo, we're going to come to my part of the world now. I am speaking to you from our luxury podcasting studio on the banks of the River Thames here in London. And we will go just a little ways across the North Sea to talk about Germany. We have had some interesting developments going on in German politics. That's a phrase that listeners might not always be accustomed to hearing. But, it's a very interesting and important moment in Berlin at the moment, because we have just had Chancellor Angela Merkel, who is embarking on her fourth term as the country's leader, hosting Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It was a very contentious visit that probably didn't give either side what they were hoping to achieve, from that kind of diplomatic event. And, I think that, a lot of the coverage of this is focused on the Turkish angle, because Erdogan himself is very weakened economically at home, is the subject of growing concern, about ramping up his authoritarian rule in Turkey. But, at the same time that was going on, he was visiting a weakened German chancellor. Was returned to office barely in a national election in October last year that really struggled to produce any sort of clear result. I think that all of the major parties lost ground. The big winner was a far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD party, that is making a lot of people very nervous. Here you have the spectacle of Angela Merkel in a very weakened position, trying to navigate all sorts of diplomatic and political minefields associated with the EU's relationship with Turkey, a bunch of free speech and political repression issues that people had hoped that she would address when she had Erdogan in town that seemed not to have been on the agenda in the same way. I mean, it really seems like all of a sudden the Eurozone's largest economy is somehow very politically adrift.
Well, why did Angela Merkel invite Erdogan in the first place? And secondly, why did they make it a state visit? That seems to have occasioned a lot of criticism within Germany that, it's fine to engage with Erdogan and talk to him, but why give him the face of a state visit? I'm assuming that he demanded it, but why did Merkel go along with it?
Well, I think that the problem that they run into, and I think this has been especially the case since the 2015 migration crisis in Europe, because if listeners cast their minds back to that event, the big problem that Merkel and other European leaders felt that they needed to solve was a large flow of, a million or more refugees who were coming up, out of Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, coming through Turkey into the Balkans and then up through Europe, into Central Europe. And, at that time, the solution really was to try to find some way that they could work with Erdogan to arrest the flow of these migrants in Turkey. But the price of that has been, to continue diplomatic engagement with him, even at times when it makes them very uncomfortable. And, complicating this is also the fact that, Merkel presides over a population of about 83 million or so people in Germany, 3 million of whom are ethnic Turks, who we saw this week, seem to have varying degrees of affinity for Erdogan. I mean, I thought that one of the more interesting angles on this visit was just the large number of people that he seemed to be able to get out to wave the Turkish flag and really seemed to be supporting him in the streets of some of these German cities.
Right. So essentially Merkel owes him big time for saving her from the migrant crisis. Is that fair to say? I mean, there's still a flow of migrants coming to some extent through North Africa and across the Caribbean in boats, but the major flows dissipated quite dramatically after, was it 2000 into 2016? It really fell off.
Right, and you're absolutely right that what has happened is that the flow of migration has shifted from the Balkan route that would have gone through Turkey and into Greece and then up into Europe. It's shifted more to a Mediterranean route through North Africa, but the way you put it, I think, is pretty accurate, that there is now the sense that Merkel especially owes Erdogan something, even though this is coming at a real political cost for her. I mean, you had a lot of problematic aspects of this visit up to and including the fact that the two of them hold a press conference where the Turkish side managed to deny press credentials to reporters who were believed to be hostile to Erdogan's regime back home. So, you know, suddenly you have Merkel embroiled in, various of these democracy or freedom of speech debates, being criticized for her failure to stand up to that kind of tactic on Erdogan's part. And yet, so that kind of accentuates the sense that she is politically weakened at home, but at the same time that she doesn't necessarily feel empowered to stand up too vigorously, because there is still this real sense that Europe needs cooperation with Turkey in various ways to keep the migration situation under control.
So before last year's election, Merkel seemed to be benefiting from the sense that she was she could not be defeated. There was a sense of inevitability that she would continue to be chancellor. That started to dissipate with the poor election results. And now it seems like it's even accelerating, that things are really starting perhaps to fall apart for her. And it's concentrating people's minds on what comes after Merkel.
Yeah, this is happening a lot faster than I will admit that I thought that it would. I thought that we were probably going to get another couple years of very quiet, low-level jockeying for position to replace her. But, suddenly over the past few weeks, there's this real sense that it's becoming difficult, for her to hold her coalition together. I mean, over the summer, we had this whole kerfuffle between her Christian Democratic Union Party, which is the center-right party for most of Germany, and their center-right coalition partners in the Christian Social Union, which is the Bavarian center-right party. Again, it was an uproar over how to handle the migration crisis, what to do with asylum applicants as their claims were being processed in Germany, that sort of question. That really seems to have set off, set in motion a bunch of other events. It's like people now suddenly feel like maybe they don't need to wait for a couple years. So we've had a few rather embarrassing personnel shuffles that have happened for her. Members of her own party in the Bundestag, the lower house of the parliament, did not sign off on her choice for the party leader within the parliament, which I think was an embarrassing setback for her. And at the same time, you have her center-left coalition partners in this grand coalition she cobbled together, the Social Democratic Party or the SPD, who are thinking that maybe they need to really be stepping away from her, too, that they can't afford to be so accommodating to her in another of these grand coalitions for such a long time after they suffered a very embarrassing, devastating election result last year, when their base was tired of this kind of governance. So it's almost like the political class in Berlin is trying to figure out, how are we going to respond to the demands that we think that we heard from voters for more competitive politics last year?
So who are the stars coming up? Is there anybody we should be watching, or parties that you think will be able to capitalize on Merkel's weakness?
Well, again, I think that it's going to be a little too soon to try to speculate in that kind of horse race type of way, because she has been such a dominant force in the party for such a long time that, kind of like the banyan tree cuts off the light to all of the plants that would try to grow under it. It is going to take a while for them to figure out who might be viable replacements for her. I mean, one of the big questions is going to be, is it going to come from within, is Germany's next leader going to come from within one of these mainstream parties, or are we going to end up in a situation where, parties like the AfD or also, some of these, you would almost call them fringe parties, they've been around for a lot longer, like the Greens, like the Free Democratic Party, which is the closest thing to a free market party that Germany has. Those parties historically have, barely managed to poll around 10% in a good year, in a good election for them. But you wonder, are they able to capitalize in some way over the next couple of years on voters' desire for more competition, potentially for bolder policy ideas? So it's, what is fascinating is if we'd had this conversation about 15 months ago, I think that everyone would have told you that Germany was a very boring country, that nothing seemed to be happening there politically. Suddenly, things are happening. And you know, I think that that really is actually good for us, Hugo, because it's going to give us things to talk about on these podcasts, you know, moving forward. But I think we will have to leave it there for today, because we've covered about as much global disorder as I think that we can realistically expect to handle in one podcast. So I will thank you, Hugo, for joining me. Please,
Thank you.
Well, please give Hugo a follow on Twitter at Hugo Restall, all one word. And you can find me on at Joseph Sternberg, also all one word. And please be sure to follow the Foreign Edition podcast wherever you get your audio content, Dan, to make sure that you're up to date on every dose of global disorder that we deliver. So thanks to everyone for listening. This has been Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and we will talk to you later this week.